dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
Tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio on 88.1, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. When the first Earth Day was celebrated 33 years ago, the problems of polluted air, soil and water, pesticide contamination, nuclear waste, and ozone depletion were already serious. In the intervening years, citizens have fought corporate lobbies to pressure government to take steps to deal with environmental contamination with mixed success. Corporations have struggled to escape environmental laws. This motivation has contributed to the creation of the World Trade Organization and related trade treaties that allowed them to either shift manufacturing to countries where environmental protections are absent, as well as to use WTO provisions to challenge the local laws. The latest Take the Money and Run scheme has been the development of the biotechnology industry, where many of the corporations involved in the most deadly chemical pollution of the past have morphed into today's gene giants. As in the past, the rush to profit has resulted in the dissemination of products into the environment with little consideration or knowledge of the consequences on human or planetary health. Next month, the biotech industry will hold its annual trade conference in St. Louis, which is also the home of Monsanto, one of the most aggressive marketers of genetically modified products. A counter-conference, Biodevastation 2003, will also be in St. Louis to challenge the industry as it has for the past several years. Our first speaker, Dr. David Suzuki, is a geneticist, environmentalist, and host of the Canadian television program, The Nature of Things. He spoke in Toronto at last year's Biodevastation Conference about the scientific questions that the biotech industry and their government supporters have brushed aside.
Precisely because of the revolutionary nature of genetics, of biotechnology, that I think we have to consider all the more its potential impact and take it far more seriously than the scientific community is today. With the power to manipulate the very blueprint of all life on Earth, there is a very strong impulse to rush in and exploit this capability for human use, and to forget the fact that while our technological advances has been enormous, our ignorance of how the world really works is still vast. I'd like to give you some history within which to assess genetic engineering. In the 1800s, organic chemists synthesized a molecule, a very complex molecule called DDT. But it wasn't until the 1930s that a chemist named Paul Müller, working for Geigy in Switzerland, discovered that DDT kills insects. Immediately, Geigy saw an opportunity to make money, and they did. And they trumpeted DDT as a symbol of the scientific conquest of pests that had plagued humankind since the beginning of time. Through science, they promised that we would be able to eliminate some of the great scourges of humankind. It was only after billions of pounds of DDT had been made and used, after Geigy earned millions and millions of dollars in profit, and Paul Müller had won a Nobel Prize in 1948 for his discovery, that people began to notice something funny was happening in birds. And biologists then tracked it down and discovered a phenomenon that had never been known before called biomagnification. You spray at parts per tens of millions into the surroundings. Microorganisms consume it and absorb it. They are eaten by bigger organisms, and at each trophic level up the food chain, you concentrate the DDT. So when you get to the fatty tissue of the shell glands of birds or the breasts of women, you have concentrated DDT hundreds of thousands of times. We didn't even know about the phenomenon of biomagnification until eagles began to disappear. CFCs, When chemists made CFCs, again, they were hailed as these miraculous compounds, complex molecules that are chemically inert. They don't react chemically with anything else. So they're perfect to put into aerosol spray cans. You put your underarm deodorant or whatever it is you want in the aerosol spray cans, and then you fill it up with CFCs. You top it up. And it was only years later that people realized, because they're chemically inert, they don't disappear. They persist in the environment and eventually waft into the upper atmosphere, where ultraviolet light from the sun breaks chlorine-free radicals off the CFCs, and chlorine-free radicals scavenge ozone. When scientists began to tell us that CFCs cause a thinning of the ozone layer, most of us had never even known there was an ozone layer up there. So over and over again, the history of technology informs us. We are very good. We are very creative at inventing technology. But our knowledge of how the world works is so limited that we are simply unable to anticipate the repercussions of those manipulations. Our technology tells us then to be very, very careful. DDT, CFCs, antibiotics, even radioisotopes eventually decay or break down over time. But genetically engineered organisms are living, reproducing creatures. They mutate, they reproduce, they spread, and once they're released, you can never call them back into the laboratory. That's the context, I believe, within which we should be considering our newfound prowess in biotechnology. Let us consider transgenic organisms, or what have become commonly or popularly known as genetically modified organisms in agriculture, GMOs. Throughout evolution, the very definition of a species was a group of organisms that were not able to exchange DNA with others that were closely related to them. That's the very definition of a species. You don't shift DNA between others that are not of the same species. Today, we can take genes from a bacterium, insert them into a plant or animal, from any plant and stick them into an animal, vice versa. This is a simple thing to do. This is revolutionary, because in nature, genes aren't transmitted in that fashion. Geneticists study their area. They derive genetic principles by carrying out very simple tests. They take a male and a female of the same species, they cross them, they get their offspring, then they cross the offspring and get their offspring, and so on, all within a single species. This is called vertical inheritance. All of the principles on which genetics is based were derived from vertical inheritance, studying crosses of this type. What transgenic organisms represent is a different kind of inheritance, where you take DNA from one species and transfer it horizontally to an organism of a different species. Vertical inheritance, horizontal inheritance are fundamentally different modes of inheritance. And yet geneticists overwhelmingly make the mistake of assuming that the principles derived from vertical breeding are applicable to horizontal transfer of DNA. To me, it's obvious that is just crummy science. What allows people to make such easy extrapolations? But then I'm told, but Suzuki, you don't understand. You've been out of science so long. It's all DNA. It doesn't matter. It's just pieces of DNA. And DNA in a bird or a bacterium or an animal, they're all the same. All that biotechnologists are doing is just shuffling pieces of DNA around. It's natural. Well, it's not natural for a firefly gene to be inserted into a tobacco plant, or a flounder gene to be stuck into a tomato plant, even if it is just DNA that we're manipulating. You see, in nature, evolution doesn't act by selecting on each DNA molecule or each gene by itself. Evolution takes place on, or selects on, the expression of the total genome of an organism. Genes are inherited after fertilization, and through time, certain suites of genes are turned on or turned off in a very controlled fashion throughout development and differentiation. That's how development proceeds, by the orchestrated activation and inactivation of genes through time. The expression of all of those genes in that orchestration is called an organism's phenotype, the way it appears in the end. Evolution acts on the phenotypic expression of the complete genome, not on each gene by itself. So when you take a gene out of a flounder and stick it into a tomato plant, you have changed the genomic context within which that flounder gene finds itself. It has never found itself in that kind of group of genes. And then what geneticists do is say, well, we're just putting DNA in there and it'll start to function. Something will happen. If you took Bono out of U2 and stuck them into the Toronto Symphony and said, make music, noise would come out of that, but there is no way that you can anticipate the consequences. And yet biotechnologists take a chunk of DNA out of one organism, introduce it into a totally different biological context, and think that they know what they're doing. Their own papers, for God's sake. Just read the papers that come out in biotechnology. Over and over again, what you find is they say, we did this manipulation and we thought we would get this result, and we got something completely unexpected. That's why most of us do science. If you knew what the results were going to be, why the hell would you do the experiment? That's boring. We do science, we do experiments to find things that we didn't know. And most of what biotechnologists are doing is that kind of manipulation. They're surprised, and when they get a surprise, they can then publish it. We don't know the long-term effects of these transgenic manipulations. We don't know what it's going to do to the organisms within which we carry out the manipulations. We certainly don't know what's going to happen when we introduce such organisms into the food stream. And we don't know what's going to happen when we start making drugs, which are being used by these manipulations, or we begin to use them for other purposes. It's too early. You know, we've learned through painful experience in the United States and other places that you don't include people in an experiment without getting informed consent. You tell them what the experiment's about, you tell them what you're going to do to them, and then you ask them to say, okay. You know what Europeans, who take food much more seriously than we do in North America, you know what they say about GMOs? If you want to find out whether they're dangerous or not, just watch the Canadians. They're doing the experiment for us. We have been involved in a massive experiment for over 5 years now. GMOs are in the food stream, and we've never given our consent. What these companies and what the governments, which seem to be in cahoots, the governments that we elect and set up institutions to protect our health and our well-being, but who seem to think biotechnology is the greatest thing going and have become cheerleaders for the industry rather than protectors of the public, what they say is that there are enormous, enormous benefits to be gained from genetic engineering, and that we can't afford to lose this wave of technology and stock prices that are passing through our society. I have to tell you that as a geneticist, I can't help but be swept up in the excitement of what's going on. And I certainly understand what the enthusiasm is all about. And it may very well be that in the future, biotechnology may in fact be a very important part of the environmental and the health and the food crises that we are going to encounter in the coming years. But believe me, it's far too soon to have any of this stuff in our food stream, in our medical stream, or out in open fields. It's far too soon. I graduated from the University of Chicago with a PhD in 1961. And man, I was as hot as anybody. We knew about DNA and genes and chromosomes. We knew a hell of a lot back then. And we thought we were going to go out and conquer the world. When I tell students in the lab today, the best, the most advanced models that we had for genetics in 1962, they fall on the floor laughing. Because, of course, in the year 2002, the hot ideas of 1961 seem ludicrous. They are ludicrous. But they don't understand that 20 years from now, when they are hotshot professors, and they tell their students what they believed in 2002, their students are going to fall on the floor laughing at their ideas. Don't we understand? The nature of science in any cutting-edge field, in any revolutionary discipline, the nature of science is most of your current ideas are wrong. That's not a denigration of science. It's the very way that science progresses. You make a set of observations. Wow, you've never known that before. Then you try to make sense of those observations by setting up a hypothesis that seems to explain it. Then you do an experiment to test the hypothesis. You get the results. You compare the results with what you predicted. Chances are overwhelming. You say, man, oh man, was I ever wrong? You know, we could better throw that idea out and revise it and make another hypothesis. That's the best of science. That's how science progresses. But it means that most of your current ideas are tentative. We propose these ideas with humility, knowing that the chances are overwhelming, they're going to be wrong. And it's only when the science has matured to a point where you can actually say, I am going to remove with precision these particular base pairs in a sequence of DNA, and I am going to stitch them into exactly this position on the chromosome of this organism, and I know exactly what the expression of that will be, then you can say, now it's time for us to start or considering the next level up, which is, how can we apply them? Still with a great deal of care. So what I say is, I'm not saying that we should shut the technology down. I'm just saying that it is an immature science. It's at the beginning of a revolutionary shift in the way that we view everything. And it's far too early to start releasing this out in a way that will affect large numbers of people. I'd also like to tell you, the problem with many geneticists involved in this work today, they've begun to believe what they write up in grant proposals. If you're a scientist, the way you write up a grant proposal is this. You say, you know, whatever your field is, I'm interested in the rectal temperature of penguins. And you say, now if I go out and measure the rectal temperature of enough penguins, that's going to lead to a new insight into thermal regulation and of Antarctic birds, and that's going to lead to this, and then you end up with a cure for cancer. And that's how we write up our grant proposal. Everybody understands that. You make it seem as if this is what your project is. The reality is, that's not the way science proceeds at all. If that's the way science went, we'd know all the answers to everything. The reality is, science goes zigzagging all over the place, and two people who may be investigating totally unrelated phenomena suddenly come together at a pub and start talking, and they say, Jesus, you know, that's a good idea. Maybe we could, and then you end up leading to a discovery that you can then begin to apply. That's the reality of science. But they really want you to believe that biotechnology is an activity where if we can get the money, we can do this and this and this, and we can save all of the species on the planet, or we can begin to engineer, ramp up the yield of plants in the same amount of ground, and so on. They're not honest with you about the nature of scientific advance. So I say, if in fact science moves in such an erratic way, if in fact we are at the bare beginning, the infancy of a revolutionary area, where we simply don't have the predictive powers of a mature science, if most of our current ideas are wrong, then what the hell is the hurry? What is the rush? And of course the answer is, it's not about saving humanity. It's not about protecting forests and reducing their destruction. It's about money. It's about money that underlies the rush to get products out, that we then rationalize by layering over all of these other excuses for why you want to get this stuff out. So when a Patrick Moore, an apologist for the biotech companies, or when Monsanto begins to tell you about all of the social benefits, my answer is, wait a minute, where do you make your money? Where are you getting paid? And the minute you find the source of the money, then maybe there's a strong reason to suspect the credibility of many of those spokespeople. You are all here because you know in your gut that this is a swizz, that this is something being foisted on us. It doesn't feel right, it doesn't smell right. And you are absolutely right. Thank you for coming out.
That was Dr. David Suzuki, Canadian geneticist, environmentalist, and broadcaster, speaking at last year's Biodevastation Conference in Toronto. Our next speaker made a shattering discovery of the extent of contamination that has already occurred in one of our most important food crops. Mariah Gallardon of TUC Radio in San Francisco spoke recently with UC Berkeley biologist Dr. Ignacio Chapella.
Corn is essential to our survival. It's the second most important grain after rice. It feeds people and animals and is an ingredient in most processed foods. Corn is made into sugar, oil, or automobile fuel, and is even used in dyes, paints, and chemicals. Corn and corn silk are used in healing. Not surprisingly, biotechnology companies have engineered corn, either by making it resistant to herbicides or insects. The health effects on us are still unknown, mainly because they're not investigated. However, a study done at Cornell University showed that monarch butterflies have a high death rate when eating pollen from genetically engineered corn. Almost half of all corn grown and eaten in the U.S. is genetically engineered, the highest percentage anywhere in the world. Our neighbor Mexico, for example, does not allow any engineered corn to be planted for fear that it would contaminate their precious stocks of ancient indigenous corn. From the beginning, the industry has claimed that genetically engineered corn was non-toxic as well as stable, that it would not cross-pollinate with organic corn. That claim was shattered when researchers from the University of California, Berkeley, found that contamination had reached the cradle of corn, the remote Oaxacan villages of the Zapotecan Indians, in spite of the Mexican ban on planting. The story of that discovery was published in the science magazine of record, Nature. It shook the world and made headlines in major European papers. It left the Zapotecan Indians with a deep sense of betrayal. For over 10,000 years, through droughts and wars, they had kept their precious corn alive. They protected it from invading Aztecs, Spaniards, and even Mexico City developers, only to find that this invasion of their corn came with stealth, invisible. A tiny bacteria had entered the DNA of their plants. Somebody had rewritten the blueprint of their corn. The story begins in October of 2000, when scientists from the University of California, Berkeley, helped set up the first indigenous lab to analyze the pure corn of the Zapotecan Indians. The tests showed that the cradle of corn, the center of biodiversity, had been invaded by genetically modified varieties. It showed that a product of a biotech lab in the U.S. will show up in remote mountains in Oaxaca, even though the Mexican government forbids the planting of engineered corn. And it was not just a question of weeding out the offending plants. A virus used in plant genetics had inserted itself into the genome of some of the ancient corn. The scientists who made the discovery were Ignacio Chapella, assistant professor at the Department of Environmental Science at the University of California, Berkeley, and his grad student, David Quist. They worked for a year to verify their results, and in November 2001, the renowned science magazine of record, Nature, published the report. The biotech industry hired a PR company to discredit the research. The campaign was initially so successful that Ignacio Chapella feared that this would be the end of his career. On the other hand, public interest has not only kept the issue alive, but has grown over time. Chapella's nephew in Mexico told him recently that his name now turns up more entries in an internet search than a famous pop star. A book is being written and European TV has covered it. In the U.S., however, the story is still quite unknown. This story of corn, as told by Ignacio Chapella, also raises deep philosophical questions about the interaction of humans and nature over time. Chapella says that we are really changing the biosphere and the face of the earth, and the challenge is for us to comprehend changes that are invisible and yet so profound that they affect all of us, and our children and children's children, everywhere. Three friends and I met with Ignacio Chapella in the back of a Berkeley bookstore and sat in almost casual conversation to hear his story of corn. We began by asking Ignacio Chapella to take us to the Zapotecan village in Oaxaca, where the story began. Here's Ignacio Chapella, assistant professor for microbial ecology at UC Berkeley.
This region is a place that has a very long history, at least going 10,000 years back, where we know corn was domesticated and where people have kept corn going for all these thousands of years despite all kinds of challenges. They have always managed to maintain two things. One is their communal access to the land and management of those landscapes, and the other one is their communal access and management of the seed. We come into this story very, very recently, about 15 years ago. By that I mean myself as well as other people that I collaborated with, mostly from Mexico City, but some people from abroad, because people around there are very conscious that they need to keep up with management of the resources in as good a way as possible. And they were asking questions about microbes. They were asking questions about things that one cannot see. And at that point, we started building up a lab, training people, incorporating this capacity into what they already have as a very well-established capacity to do management of plants, management of animals, and other things that you can see. And it was in this context that we started thinking from our knowledge here in the U.S. that we are releasing all these transgenic organisms into the environment. We started, you know, suspecting that we would see, sooner or later, we would see contamination, pollution of the local land races of their crop with industrial varieties. And so we decided in my lab here in Berkeley to go there and try to help set up monitoring capacity. The way we did it was by sending David Quist, my graduate student, down with some positive controls, that is corn from cans from the supermarket here. And then he was planning to look at the local land races of corn as negative controls, thinking, you know, if there is a place that we think of as pristine and far away and well-kept and so on, this is it, so we should not have contamination there. We also knew that the Mexican government had established a moratorium, a ban on the planting of transgenic corn, so we thought that there shouldn't be anything like that in Mexico in general. But at the same time, many people had been raising the question that transgenic material can move from industrial crops through pollen and through other means into places that should not be expected. So we went prepared to set up the foundation for the monitoring capacity so that in, you know, 5, 10, 15 years or whatever, whenever the contamination came, we would be ready to see it. Because in contrast with chemical pollution or chemical contamination, genetic contamination you cannot see. You cannot detect really readily with the naked eye. So you have to be prepared, you have to be looking, otherwise you don't see it. And that's one of the big tragedies about it, because you can have massive transformations of the biosphere without, if you're not trained, if you don't have the capacity to look for it, you just don't see it. Everything looks green, everything looks growing, and yet it is, you know, vastly changed. So David goes there, he prepares a workshop. Many people are interested. They're going to show up the following day, but he's, you know, very conscious, and he sets up a trial run at night to check that everything is running fine and so on. So he calls early in the morning. I'm here in Berkeley, and he wakes me up, and he says, Ignacio, there is a little problem here. The workshop will start in about 2 hours, and I'm getting all these negative controls showing positive. What should I do? And it was a difficult question, because what do you do when you have to break the news to a group of people who hardly know what transgenics are. And besides, you cannot be really 100% sure. My immediate reaction was to say, you know, David, I think that it might be contamination. You might have some false positives there. So I would not hide anything from anybody. I would run exactly the same samples and develop it, so to speak. But I would also not make much bones about it. I would not make a scandal out of it until we're really sure about it. This is October of 2000. We spent months up until March of 2001 running all kinds of confirmations and controls and reruns and everything to make sure that we were right. Of course, we knew this would be a scandal, not as big as it has become. We really never thought it would be quite so big. But we knew it would be scandalous, as it should have been. So we tried to make sure that everything was in place, and then we submitted the paper to Nature. At that point, really, it was the point where everything started snowballing. The whole dynamics of the scientific establishment started kind of getting tremors about it. Something that's, I think, really important about the story is that we are quite illegitimate. I am not a plant molecular biologist. David isn't either. The discovery was done in a laboratory that's owned and run by a coalition of indigenous communities. So it was just totally off the radar from the main establishment. And that, to this day, I think, is the main thrust of why there is this incredibly rapid attack on the discovery. I've been to meetings sometimes where people say, oh, but, you know, they bang on the table and they say, I've been in this field for 25 years or 40 years or whatever, and I would never, ever have done that. And, I mean, it speaks for itself that somebody who has been in the field for so long and had never asked this question and had never dared look should be out. You know, it should not be. There's something wrong with the field if the field is not doing that. And I don't think it is coincidental that the discovery was made from outside the field.
Now, I understand that if you look at the genetic structure of a corn plant, it's fairly unambiguous to discover if it has been engineered because of certain markers in it.
Yes, that's right. Providing evidence of contamination is very straightforward. That's something that has been lost through the debate about this in the last few months, although it's being recovered, I think, as you are doing here. The discovery of contamination has never been challenged. The picture is very clear. It was clear with our very limited sample, and it has been clear for anybody who has looked. And there have been at least 5 independent rounds of looking. So anybody who has looked has found much higher levels of contamination than we found in Oaxaca. But apparently that's not enough for people to pay attention to it.
Can I ask you a question, Ignacio? Can you speak to the cultural implications of the discovery, of your discovery, mm-hmm. among the Oaxacans, for whom the idea of the contamination of corn will be something profoundly important, I suppose?
Yeah, that's a question that has troubled me from the beginning about this. Even coming into the field of corn in Mexico is something that is really daunting. Of course, you know, Mesoamerican cultures are the cultures of corn. There are the myths of creation in these cultures are always associated to corn. According to one of those myths, the Aztecs apparently, I understand, have this chronology of creations. There have been many stages of creations, and I think this is the 5th, or I can't remember the number, of creational rounds. And this is the age of corn. All the world that we're living in is the world of corn, and it will go under and something else will come, but right now it's the world of corn. So there are really massive and very deep cultural implications to the discovery of pollution. The concept of pollution and contamination from the outside world, from the U.S., from industrial hybrids and so on, was there. People meaning the campesinos in the mountains are have been aware of this for a long time, but the discovery of this transgenic thing that has attracted reporters from the international community, TV crews, and it just seems to be such a big scandal, makes it much more dramatic what they already knew. People are very concerned, more than anything, because they were never told. They know that this is something that is done upon them, that these are changes, transformations of this very important part of their lives that were caused and created by someone outside. And there is this feeling of outrage at the fact, at the realization that this is true. At the same time, they're not victims. I mean, they're not in the victim role normally, like some other indigenous groups in Mexico might be. They're survivors. As I said before, they're survivors of thousands of years. So they're also using this to underscore and support their plight that they have been talking about for at least a century, which is the problem that they face when they are inserted into an international trade community. There is a real, very direct connection between me as a taxpayer, here in the Bay Area, how that money goes to support or hardly support a farmer in the Corn Belt of the U.S. to do soil mining, to do water mining, to do environmental mining in the sense that they do agriculture that ends up killing the mouth of the delta of the Mississippi and so on, to produce this underpriced, subsidized corn to be dumped into the international market, and my money as a taxpayer continues to flow in the international market, goes into Mexico as contaminating corn, finds its way to the deepest and most remote parts of the country, and gets to this place where the campesino is facing the decision of what seed to put in the ground. At that point, they are faced with the decision of putting in seed that they have to pay, they have to subsidize themselves from their pocket to be able to plant, or the seed that is being distributed and provided to them from the federal government stores. And many people do the, you know, what an economist would do, an economist here would say is the rational thing. They would take the cheaper seed and put it in the ground. They continue planting that, but it's not good enough. It ends up being unsatisfactory. Many people are moving out from the land. Many of these agricultural lands are being let fallow or reforested. And these people are finding their way back to California as, you know, domestic workers or agricultural laborers. And then you have this circuit closed from me here with my tax money to those people who end up coming here too. In between, you have the biological reality of this pollution of corn and the loss of the diversity of this very important crop that we as humanity are losing as we speak. There is the almost mythical cultural consequences of the contamination that really resonate very deep, and I really believe this is not going to go away in Mexico. This might overturn a precedent, overturn a whole regime. I think corn can be the thing, the lever that can really fire people up to do something about what's happening. And beyond that, there are also the cultural implications of our survival as humanity, that humanity that has been based, whether we like it or not, whether we recognize it or acknowledge it or not, on agriculture.
I just taped somebody named Andres Barreda. He said that with NAFTA, war began in Mexico on the indigenous peoples, and that the war for liberation of indigenous peoples was bound up with their resistance to what he called biodevastation.
Yeah, it is very clear that it's not about money. I talked before about how the econometrically rational decision for a campesino in Mexico is to stop planting their own corn. In fact, to stop planting corn altogether. And this is exactly what the economists in Mexico City have done. Explicitly, very explicitly and repeatedly have said, we need to get these people out of the land. If they cannot compete in the international market, they need to move out. Go into the city, die, whatever, but they're not economically viable. They should move out. So the very fact that there is corn being planted, that there is indigenous land races of corn still on the ground and still growing, is, I think, a testimony to the really severe limitations of this econometric analysis, for one thing. But more than that, much more important, is a real testament to the fact that people move by other reasons, from other sources. They will do things that you would not be able to model with an econometric modeling effort, like maintaining this crop on the land.
I had always wished I'd meet somebody, and now you're here, mm-hmm. who can describe to me what it looks like there, you know, how remote it is, and how many varieties of corn still are carefully tended there. That's like over 100, I understand.
I haven't been to India. I haven't been to Ethiopia or Turkey. I really want to go to those places, but I imagine they must be like this. China, I've seen pictures of the Yunnan province in China, and it looks like this. And I think the thing that really strikes me from all these different places in the centers of diversity in the world is that is the enormous diversity, the sheer difference that you find from one spot to the other. It just hits you with diversity at every corner. The other thing that all these areas have in common is that there is no way that you can think of these areas as devoid of people. The diversity that you see in plants, that you see in soils, that you see in altitudes and exposures, and how the wind is blowing, and whether this wind has water or not in it, and whether it is exposed to frost or not, and so on. This diversity you see in people, too. These are people who have been there for very long, and they have taken from the diversity of the land, or they have just grown into it in such a way that there is no way you can separate what's human and what's non-human. Every time that an expert, an ecologist, comes to a place and does a study, they discover that many of the species that you find in a place, even though it might look really remote, and you know there are monkeys and there are toucans and there are all kinds of wonderful birds and other animals flying around. But no matter how remote it looks and how wild, every time you look, you can see the footprint of human manipulation, of human interaction, even the most remote places. And the same way the other way around. People who live there have been... you cannot see them as separate from the non-human. In this corn, for example, in this case, for example, the corn makes a very, very strong link between that non-human and human spheres. Yeah, that translates into color and into sound and scent and all kinds of very sensual things that these landscapes have.
You know, people who go there in order to find varieties that are almost extinct or not known, they probably look at it as a place of treasure. Wasn't that the first impetus of people who were looking for the disappearing relations to the industrialized corn that we need to protect in order to protect even the horrendous monocultural corns, because they will be vulnerable unless they get infusions from wildness?
That's actually right. When the corn blight in the 1970s and then again in the 1980s hit the U.S., all these stories came out that, scientists saw this happening, saw the blight coming, and they just ran to Mexico, to Oaxaca, and they just grabbed genes from there and put them quickly into the corn, the industrial corn, and then the next year's harvest was saved. You know, that's a story you'll see in the newspapers. But the reality is that that's not the way it happens. Again, the times of living things are very different from the times of chemical things or nuclear accidents and so on. The the maintenance of an agricultural system, whether it is the one that we're mostly fed from here, which is industrial agriculture, or the one that campesinos in that area, in those areas in Oaxaca, are fed from, those systems are really supported by long-term processes. So the introduction of genes, of genetic material from Oaxaca to U.S. hybrids or international hybrids in Africa or wherever you want to find them, and this applies for all crops, this introduction is something that takes a very long time. So the genes that saved the U.S. corn harvest in the 1970s from the blight were genes that were introduced maybe 15 years before, where the breeders didn't know what they were doing. They were not expecting anything specific, but they were maintaining this diversity in their lines for the eventuality of a challenge like that, like the corn blight. And, you know, it worked. But it can only work as long as you have that basis of diversity and as you keep this dynamic of interaction with it. Many people wrongly believe that by taking the seeds from these areas and putting them in vaults, like we have in places like the Center for Research and Improvement of Corn and Wheat in Mexico City, or Fort Collins and Iowa here in the U.S., many people believe that by putting seeds into these vaults, we can save that diversity and just have it as a bank account, so to speak, where we could draw from. And that, of course, is totally wrong. You have to keep these things alive, and you have to keep them alive long term. And the only way to keep crop variety alive is to keep people alive who are relating to this diversity. It applies to corn, it applies to rice, it applies to wheat and sorghum and potatoes and whatever you want. It's theoretically impossible to come up with a system that would support the diversity per se, the living diversity per se, other than having humans interacting with the crops. Even the very destructive industrial agriculture that we have, we must maintain that diversity down there. And when we are confronted with an unsolvable problem, we will not have the resources to confront it. That's it. One of the main policymakers in biotech from the European Union asked the question, do we have a technology here? Do we have anything to patent here? Are we talking of anything that we could call a technology at all? And the answer, the honest answer from a biological perspective is no. There is nothing here that you can patent. What you have done is you have learned how to insert yourself or your little interest into the game of life, into the main course of life. And you're tumbling around in this course, and you think that you know what you're doing, when in reality it's absolutely not true. A technology is something that allows you to put a blueprint on paper and say, this is going to be a VW Beetle. And then you follow that blueprint and you get a VW Beetle and you turn the key and it does something that you know it's going to do, and it just takes you wherever you want to go. And you know how to fix it, and you know how to, you know, that is a technology. There's nothing comparable to that in biotechnology, in fiddling with life. What we do is a very, very rudimentary, crude attempt at getting living organisms to do what we tell them to do. What makes people so arrogant, I believe, who can get away with saying, oh, I did this, and therefore I produced this mouse who glows in the dark and who does this thing that will do what I tell it to do, is, again, just a testament to the power of life, to the enormous capacity of life to take in its stride. Even these crazy alterations of what life usually does. So it has nothing to do with the power of the technologist trying to alter the course of that, but actually with the course of that living thing taking in its stride the enormous assault. How can you patent something that you don't even know you're doing? How can you patent something whose mechanism you have never described, or even you could never even dream of understanding at this point, which is really the honest situation that we are in biology today.
It's interesting for me to hear that a European person would call this a technology, so that's the definition of patent right there. And it's very similar to here, machines, mm-hmm. really heavy philosophical concept that the patenting of life asserts life as machine.
There is so much about biotechnology that really is, I think, a very cheap attempt at sequestering or piggybacking on the enormous success of things like electronics technology or even nuclear technology, the particle physics advances and so on. But a quarter century into it, there isn't a single product of biotechnological manipulations that one can speak of in the same terms. There is nothing that is not even conceivably with the potential of a recorder or a personal computer or a pager or anything like that in biotechnology that, you know, a normal citizen would like to have and would be willing to pay money for. There's nothing like that coming from this manipulation of lives. I think there's just so much hubris and arrogance in all this that gets denied over and over and over again every time a seed germinates, every time, you know, an animal is born, every time something actually works in the living world. That arrogance and that hubris is denied. You know, we're still working. It's still running. We are pushing it. We're really trying. We're really pushing it to the edge. But there is just an enormous resilience that I think is, yes, it's good news. Might not be very good news to us as humans, but it's in general good news if what you like is life.
I wish I was as optimistic about it, because some of the urgency that I wanted this meeting to happen comes from this enormous crime, really, to contaminate, put things into nature that can never be recalled, that go on. Yes, hopefully they won't be stable. Hopefully these genes will be silenced, as that's a famous expression already. That's beautiful. That can be done by a plan to reject, but it's out there. It is like really the mythological thing about setting something in motion that you have no power over, like nuclear power.
I think both points of view are not contradictory. I think what Barbara is talking about is good news from an almost cosmological point of view, where we might disappear, but there will be life. And I really don't think that we're going to be able to finish life off. Maybe with nuclear power, we could just basically cook the planet and that would be it. With biotechnology, I don't think we will. It's not a question of whether there will be life or not. It's a very different question to what, you know, Russell and Einstein were confronted with. Are we going to cook ourselves? Are we going to just simply finish life on Earth? And I don't think we're confronted with that question right now. I think what we're confronted with is a very humanistic question. It's a very human-centered question of whether we want to be here and whether we want to be here as we know ourselves, as we like to think of ourselves as a civilized society. That is very much at stake. So when you talk about the challenge of the contamination of crops, the contamination of centers of diversity and so on, that is a very serious challenge, but it's a challenge to human diversity. It's a challenge to human sustainability. It's a challenge to our ability to reliably get food. And I don't think humanity is going to disappear for lack of food. We might kill a good proportion of ourselves, but there will be humans to eat whatever is left over. And even if humans disappear, there will continue to be many organisms that will be pretty happy when we go away. And change. So I think the question is very different. The optimism, I think, is cosmological. The pessimism is humanistic. And I'm very much with both.
Ignacio, can you just speak briefly to the what I imagine would be the response by the sales force of biotechnology, which is that there's nothing so far that anybody would want to go into a supermarket and say, yes, I want, you know, GM tomatoes, right? But what they're hoping and what they're promising, of course, is that the next generation of, you know, nutraceuticals, namely, you know, that there's going to be the banana with the vaccine. I take it that you'd make the same case that it's these are very crude interventions which, relatively speaking, are going to fall in upon themselves.
Yeah, I believe that very deeply. From what I know and from what I see where we're going, the foundations of what we're doing, I wouldn't have any hope that these manipulations are really going very far in. Anyway, however, that doesn't mean that from the humanistic point of view, they're not pervasive. That human culture and human survival even is not under threat from these things, no matter how in the course of evolution, no matter how temporary these alterations might be. From our point of view, they're I think very deep and very significant. There is one argument that is often hard to defeat, which is the argument of relieving human suffering. Mm-hmm. You know, we are moving in the second and third generation of biotech products to a point where we are relieving human suffering. At that point, it is possible to take pictures of faces to put in, you know, Time magazine or some, you know, place like that, where you have an individual whose suffering is being relieved by these technologies. And just the promise of that becomes such a powerful thing to just stop questioning. You're not allowed to question lest you're told that you are promoting the suffering of this little kid in Mexico, because you're not delivering the vaccine, or you're not delivering the nutraceutical, or you're not delivering this second, third generation biotech product. And I think that connects with the question of scale and the question of time, where you say, okay, the suffering of an individual, just the promise of relieving suffering from an individual who isn't even here, because we don't have anything to deliver this right now or for one or two generations, compared with the prolonged and incremental suffering of humanity for the loss of diversity, for the loss of cultural identity and diversity, for the loss of even a reliable food source. How can we put on the balance, you know, this promise for a smiley face, this one individual, against humanity, against culture, against you know, much larger questions? And but of course it's a lot harder to put this in Time magazine. It's a lot easier to just put a, you know, a sad and smiley face before and after, you know, like in those ads. I mean, the reality is that nobody cares about whether children die in Guatemala or not. Nobody cares. I think there, it's very important to recognize that what we're talking about here is transformations that have biosphere scale implications that extend over a very long time and over very large populations and over many generations. I mean, are we going to be really celebrating, no matter how, at what cost, the, you know, the smiley face of this kid who was saved disease? At no matter what cost to humanity, I don't think I would.
What could one mean by contamination beyond the profound cultural implications for the people of Oaxaca?
The least complicated answer, you say, well, all we did was to show that there is connectivity between industrial and land race corn. I'm amazed that people have tried to deny this. Because the answer that I would have if I was a propagandist of this technology would be to say, well, so what? I think it's really important anyway, because it shows that something that you do in Iowa in a laboratory is going to sooner or later find its way to the Zapotec Mountains in Oaxaca. And by the same token, a little bit deeper, is going to find its way to my genome. So the transformation of corn in Iowa laboratory is, in a very real, physical, technical sense, a transformation of the human genome, admittedly a few generations down the line. But it's true that all genomes are connected in biology, you know, over evolutionary time.